This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega.
We turn now to the urgent manhunt underway at this hour in Texas.
What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, tin house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
On Monday night, dozens of suspects absconded from the Lone Star State in a clearly coordinated action. Video evidence shows they have arrived in the District of Columbia and remain at large. The passionate group is making political demands.
Today, more than 50 Democratic members of the Texas House left Austin and left Texas. Not because we want to. It breaks our heart that we have to do it. But we do it because we are in a fight to save our democracy.
Now, these delinquents call themselves by a fanciful name of a nearly extinct creature, Texas Democrats. The goal of their swift skedaddle from the State House? To deny Texas Republicans the mandated quorum necessary to pass voting restrictions that would narrow access to the ballot for millions of the state's residents. Texas's Law and Order Governor, Republican Greg Abbott, has been unequivocal in his determination to punish these rascals upon their return.
As soon as they come back into the state of Texas, they will be arrested, they will be cabined inside the Texas Capitol until they get their job done.
Joining me now is one of the fugitive lawmakers. He's a Democrat from Round Rock, Texas, and the youngest lawmaker in the state legislature. Texas State Representative James Tallarico, welcome to the show.
Melissa, thanks for having me.
So I hope you know that was tongue-in-cheek.
Of course.
But talk to me about this decision. The way that, you know, much of it's been reported is that you all fled. So talk to me about that decision to flee.
You know, honestly, it did feel a little bit like fleeing. To coordinate a logistical feat like this is not easy. It was more than 55 legislators that had to leave the state in secrecy on Monday. And so, you know, actually, I've told people this and they don't believe me, but as of 11 a.m. Monday morning, I didn't know where we were going, how we were going to get there, where we were staying. It could have been any part of the country. I knew we had to leave the state of Texas, but didn't know where we were going. Information was shared very carefully with the members of our caucus. So it felt a little bit like a heist or a getaway. I don't know what the what the right metaphor is, but it was really, really something else. A lot of credit goes to our Democratic leadership, including our chair, Chris Turner, who you just heard in your opening, who had to coordinate this and do it in a way where we didn't get caught.
Now, the governor has been pretty clear about his intention to arrest, and a word I hadn't heard before, a cabin, all of you, if you return to the state. If you are, in fact, arrested, will this have been worth it?
Absolutely. This is a lot bigger than us, and it's a lot bigger than Texas. As you mentioned, since Donald Trump's big lie that the election was stolen, Republican legislators around the country in state capitals from Georgia to Texas have been pushing these voter suppression bills that would make it harder for people to vote and make it harder for certain people to vote, mostly Black and brown people. And as President Biden mentioned in his speech yesterday, this is the greatest threat to democracy since the Civil War. And so we're doing our small part as Texans, as elected officials, to try to save our democracy. And as you mentioned, you know, we came to D.C. for a reason, and that's to implore, beg, plead with our federal counterparts to do something and to do something now, to pass For the People Act, pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, pass whatever you need to prevent bills like the one in Texas from becoming law.
Now, the governor has also indicated that he's willing to call back-to-back-to-back special sessions from now until the next election. I assume all of you want to get home before 2022. So I'm wondering, will this strategy that you all have taken actually work? Or are we looking at the likelihood that these restrictions simply are going to pass in Texas?
So at a state level, this strategy will not work long term. I want to be very honest about that and very clear about that. The reason we're in D.C. is because we need Congress to act. And if they don't act, quickly, if they don't act before their August recess, then this bill in Texas will become law. My constituents, who I swore an oath to protect, are going to lose their sacred constitutional rights that brave Americans have fought and died for since the beginning of this project of ours. And so we are meeting with Senator Manchin this week. We already met with Vice President Kamala Harris and House leadership. And those meetings have been very productive. And we're optimistic that we may see some movement in our nation's capital. But there is no long-term play in Texas. The only play we have left is for Congress to act and to act now.
Are there any Republicans on your agenda for meeting with over the course of the next few days?
So we have reached out to Republican lawmakers, including our home state senators. You know, it's a little funny. We fled our state to serve our constituents, unlike our home state Senator Ted Cruz, who fled the state to abandon our constituents during a crisis. And so, you know, we're hoping that this is not a partisan issue. And in fact, you may know, Melissa, that the vote against this voter suppression bill the first time around a few months ago was a bipartisan vote. One of our Republican colleagues joined with us as Democrats to oppose this bill. And, you know, his reasoning was pretty interesting, because he pointed out that when Texas had record turnout in 2020, Republicans did pretty well. So this is not about protecting Democratic votes. This is protecting the votes of all of our constituents. I want Republicans to be able to access the ballot box easily. And I want them to be able to exercise that God-given right to make their voice heard in the Democratic process. And so I hope this doesn't become more of a partisan fight than it already is. And I hope Republican lawmakers meet with us when we're here in D.C.
So genuinely, I think you've hit on something that I have found a bit surprising, because, you know, not only in Texas, but around the country, precisely what you just described occurred, right? So it was not only that there was a massive turnout, right? There was a massive turnout for both parties. And I know you had that's a little cable news dust up about who actually won, although I think that's pretty clear. But that said, one could make an argument that Republicans won in the sense of bringing out more Republican voters in the last election, and therefore having, you know, a great deal of value for the Republican Party at the state level. Is there a pathway for making an argument either to your state cohort of Republicans or to federal Republicans on that?
Absolutely. You know, I work with my Republican colleagues in Texas every day, and I live in a Republican dominated state in Texas. So, you know, I can't get anything done in the state capitol unless I work with my Republican colleagues. And many of them, you know, when they're away from the TV cameras, are decent, good people who just want to make our state better. But the politics are changing in their party, and they're changing fast in their. They're changing in the wrong direction, unfortunately. And I don't want this to become a poli-sci seminar, but you know, the Republican Party, I think, is becoming a minoritarian party, which is dangerous if the Republican Party doesn't feel they can or should build a majority coalition. Then we're going to see more of this kind of radical extremist agenda, and they're not going to have a vested interest in ensuring everyone can show up to vote. And I guess my point is that it doesn't have to be that way. Not to embarrass my own party in Texas. I'm so honored to be a Texas Democrat, and we have a legacy from LBJ to Barbara Jordan to Ann Richards that I hold very dear. But I'll say, in the last election, former President Trump and Texas Republicans actually made inroads into our traditionally Democratic coalition, especially in South Texas, as you remember. So I think, you know, as a Democrat, I don't want the Republican Party to become a majoritarian party. But as a small D Democrat who believes in this Democratic project of ours, we desperately need the Republican Party to be a majoritarian party. And I this is my plea to my Republican colleagues in Texas and across the country is believe in democracy with us. And I think you'll be successful.
I feel like I hear the middle school teacher, former middle school teacher in you, in that sense of like the big D and little d Democrat, what it means to care about the processes. I want you to talk one more beat about this idea of political theater. That's not quite what you called it, but the ways that, you know, media and exposure and all of us looking in the fishbowl of the state house impacts, right, sort of what happens for all of you. And the governor has said that you all are on a taxpayer junket to D.C. Maybe you could just help folks who may not know how state legislators work. Are y'all making a lot of money? And who is paying for this trip?
So, great question. We are not using taxpayer dollars for any of this. Most of us have even rejected our state pay, which is a measly $400 a month. But have rejected that pay while we're here. And any travel expenses are being raised by our Democratic caucus the old-fashioned way, with people donating $5, $10, $15. And we've raised well over $200,000for this project already from small-dollar donors. So no taxpayer money is being used for this. But to your question about political theater, you know, this is theater, and I'll be very honest with you, Melissa. This is not what I want to be doing right now, and I think I can speak for the rest of my colleagues that this is not what we want to be doing. But we have been forced into this position by Texas Republicans. The special session that's happening in Austin, where the session that we fled from, is all theater. It's a special session composed of conspiracy theories, mythical voter fraud, trans athletes causing problems on sports teams, which we know doesn't occur, critical race theory being widespread in Texas classrooms, which we know is also not the case, although we do know historical whitewashing is occurring in our state capitol. So, you know, we're not talking about public school funding, which I care about as a former teacher. We're not talking about expanding healthcare or fixing our power grid to ensure Texans don't die again when temperatures dip a little bit. Those would be things we could focus on that would actually improve people's lives. But this, you know, Governor Abbott wants to run for president in 2024. And so he and Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida are in a race to the bottom. So this has all become theater. And it's all very loud and all very silly. And I wish that we weren't in this position. But, you know, once our Republican colleagues decided to undermine democracy, we felt we had no other option. But I would love nothing more than not to be on the phone with you. And I would love nothing more than be back at my desk at the state capitol working on an early childhood bill. That's what I want to be doing right now.
Well, Texas State Representative James Tallarico, you may not want to be on the phone with me, but anybody who name checks Barbara Jordan, talks about rat choice, does a little bit of Democratic theory, and is willing to have a complex conversation about media is absolutely always welcome here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
We wanted to know how Texas's young voters and advocates would be affected by the Republican plan and what they think about Democratic lawmaker strategy. Yesterday, we spoke with three Texans. Take a listen.
My name is Melanie Price. I am the director of the Ruth J. Simmons Center for Race and Justice at Prairie View A&M University.
My name is Majorian Schroeser-Lowe, originally from St. Louis, Missouri, but currently living in Houston, Texas. I am a 2020 Prairie View A&M alum, and I am an inaugural Marshall Mali NAACP LDF scholar and going to law school at Texas Tech University in the fall.
I'm Claudia Jolie Ferla. I live in Austin, Texas, and I am the executive director at Move Texas.
My first thought when they left really was, again, in a climate where there is such a Republican stronghold over the state government, not just the legislature, but also the governorship and also attorney general, then it seems like this is one of the clearest ways for them to stop the process and force other people around the nation to take a look at what is actually happening and what is so tragic about what's happening in this moment.
Well, the first time it happened, I was actually there. And so it was funny. The first time it happened, we were all at work. And so my boss is State Representative Ron Reynolds, who was the vice chair of the Texas Legislative Black Caucus. And we're watching the TV. We're like, wait a minute, Rep. Thompson's gone. Rep. Collier's gone. So we're like, wait a minute, where are they at? And so everybody's gone. Or maybe it was like close to midnight. Everybody's gone. And so the bill died. And so everybody was pretty excited.
For us as an organization and for us as a movement, we've applauded the pro-voter lawmakers who have once again taken a bold stance for our communities. And we thank the hundreds of young people who've made this possible through their advocacy by using their voice, showing up to testify, and organizing in their communities.
The current attention to Texas, and I think to some extent Georgia, what people in these states are trying to say is, this is dire. What is happening here is unfair, and it will have generational impact on the politics of these states.
Governor Abbott and his anti-voting co-conspirators cannot win on the issues. And so what they're trying to do is wage a war on our fundamental voting rights in a cynical attempt to hold on to their power.
I think that the Texas Democratic Party is kind of in a place of the Democrats, and the people we have elected are in a place of, you know, it's all or nothing.
It's a really scary time now as a professor whose students are activists around voting rights to believe that they might become overly frustrated, that they might become unenthusiastic about the future of their voting rights because of the heavy-handedness of the Texas state legislature.
The hardest challenge that we have as young Democrats is just communicate our message in a way that is heard and taken seriously. We need the advice from the senior people and people who have done it before us. We also need to be able to have a seat at the table and be heard.
Our goal is to document these stories and to create networks for students who are activists on their campus to work with other students across the HBCU universe, across the HBCU landscape, so that their work isn't done in silos.
We will continue to organize, mobilize, engage the young organizers who have already shown us that they will not let their voices be silenced by cynical anti-voter lawmakers. We know that Texas is ground zero for the voter right for voter suppression across the country, and we will not cede any territory in this fight.
The voices there are of Melanie Price, Madrian Strozer-Lowe, and Claudia Yoli Ferla, speaking about the fight against voter suppression in Texas. Texas Governor Greg Abbott spent some time during his presser this week trolling the heck out of the president.
Compare and contrast this with the state of Delaware, which happens to be the state where the president votes, where they have exactly 0 hours of early voting there.
On Tuesday afternoon, a fired up and ready to go President Biden joined the fray.
Time and again, we've weathered threats to the right to vote and free and fair elections. And each time we found a way to overcome.
And he urged Congress to act.
We must pass the For the People Act. It's a national imperative.
Okay, y'all, let's do this. Oh, but wait, the filibuster. For more on that and just what exactly the Biden administration hopes to accomplish, I'm joined by Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sungmin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
So President Biden seemed pretty energetic in Philly on Tuesday. Now, was he dragged into this voting rights fight or had he been itching for it?
It kind of could be seen as the former, quite frankly, because we've been seeing for some time. Well, first of all, to make it clear, the issue of voting rights has been a very important one to President Biden in his early term in office, and obviously has supported these voting legislation that have been stalled in Congress, as you just referred to. And he has spoken about the issue, but not in as animated of a way as we saw him in Philadelphia yesterday. And frankly, for the last several weeks, ever since these measures collapsed on Capitol Hill when they were deadlocked in a key vote late last month, activists, you know, civil rights leaders, progressive activists have been really itching for President Biden himself to specifically do more. First of all, be more visible, be more forceful, use the bully pulpit to make that case for legislation, for change. And you certainly saw that with this speech in Philadelphia yesterday. Obviously, you see a symbolic importance there. And the White House has signaled that he's going to continue to talk about the issue. So obviously, I would not rule out further trips around the country to zero in on this issue of voting rights.
So from a midterm election strategy, I absolutely understand that. And it sounds like he's talking to the base, he's talking to Democratic supporters and activists and organizers. But he didn't mention the filibuster, which seems to me like it would be central to an actual legislative strategy on voting rights.
Right. And that was the glaring absence that I think everyone noticed in his roughly 25-minute speech yesterday in Philadelphia, that you can make the policy case and the substantive case for legislation, for voting rights. But at the same time, he didn't talk much about how to get there and what specifically is that obstacle preventing passage of it, which is, first of all, two things. Obviously, Republican, nearly unified Republican opposition, whether it's unified opposition among Senate Republicans for the For the People Act, or the fact that there is only one Republican on board so far, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who is supporting at least taking up the voting rights revision and working on that piece of legislation. So, you know, obviously, and you heard President Biden, you know, pressure Republicans in that manner yesterday. But again, as you mentioned, the other major issue is the filibuster. And while a president has no direct power to change Senate rules, that is a rule set by the Senate and something that is voted on by senators, the fact that he didn't mention it at all last night was kind of this, again, this glaring absence that activists noticed. And it wasn't, you know, unexpected that he wouldn't mention it, because the position, the President Biden's own personal position on the filibuster is not what activists want. You know, obviously, civil rights leaders, progressive activists who have been pushing for voting rights legislation want, you know, President Biden and Senate Democrats to change the rules so you can pass legislation with a simple majority vote. And that is something that President Biden currently does not support, nor do, you know, all 50 senators.
So there are some pieces of legislation and actions, like, for example, the presidential nominations that have to be affirmed by the Senate, that can pass with simple majority. Is it possible to imagine, and is it being taken up anywhere, this kind of voting rights carve out that says this is central enough to the functioning of democracy that it's going to need to be sort of filibuster free?
The people who have mentioned this potential carve-out issue have been primarily House Democrats who don't, who again, you know, like the president himself, does not have any power over Senate rules. And there's actually a lot of questions as to how exactly this carve-out would work. And that's a question that we at the Washington Post have been asking some of these members who've proposed this, because it is complicated. And how do you write such a rule? How do you make that work? You know, for example, I've seen comments from lawmakers saying, well, there should be a filibuster exemption carve out for quote constitutional issues. A lot of things that don't necessarily seem on the surface right away are constitutional issues. So that seems very broad at this point. So there is a, you know, if you want to, there is almost always a way to write rules, legislation, whatnot. But that is a question that people who are advocating for this carve out do have to answer. How would it actually work? And we would love to see those details.
Now, worth pointing out, we do, in fact, have three branches of government as well as a federal system. And so Biden did acknowledge that legislation is just one tool, but not the only tool. What is he thinking about around or the administration thinking about around Department of Justice, Attorney General Garland, or for example, using the courts?
Right now, the Justice Department, particularly after legislative efforts stalled on Capitol Hill, has been a major focus of the Biden administration and their at least enforcement of voting rights on the books, and more importantly, challenging these new laws in a spate of Republican-led legislatures when they feel they are unconstitutional. And we saw that happen in the Justice Department lawsuit against the state of Georgia, obviously one of several lawsuits challenging that new voting law in Georgia on the books. So the Justice Department is kind of getting in line, you know, in a bunch of these lawsuits as well. And I think the administration and obviously Democratic senators on Capitol Hill have made it clear that, you know, wherever there is a legal case to be made to challenge these laws, whether they're, you know, eventually happen in Texas or Arizona or a bunch of these other states, to challenge it in the courts if they do, if the Justice Department feels that they have a case. So that's going to be a very major focal point of this administration's strategy over the next several months.
Sung Min Kim is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you, Sung Min.
Thanks so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with you now on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Infratanzina. And if you want to understand the history of Western civilization, there's one great place to start. Sugar. That's right, sugar. Sugar is much more than the yummy goodness invading everything from brownies to salad dressing. It's also a map of the world, drawing Greek scholars to India in 327 AD, fueling the Crusades 700 years later, shackling millions in the 18th century transatlantic slave trade, and earning millions for 20th century food industry titans. Sugar is sweet, but its history is bitter, a tension that persists in the way sugar is grown and gathered today. Florida harvests more than half of America's sugarcane, which means that nearly every day of the six-month harvest season, sugar companies burn dozens of cane fields. And the fires create storms of ash that fall for months on the predominantly Black and Latino residents who live nearby. The sugar industry is the largest employer in western Palm Beach County, and the confection comes with plenty of political connection. But residents are now challenging sugar companies with a lawsuit in federal court, claiming that pollution from cane burning is damaging their health. With me now to discuss is Lulu Ramadan, investigative reporter at the Palm Beach Post. And in collaboration with ProPublica, she recently published an investigation of Florida's sugar industry. Lulu, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Help me understand how important the sugar industry is to Southern Florida.
The sugar industry is really a defining feature of South Florida. It's the largest field crop in South Florida, and they have about 400,000 acres sort of centered around Lake Okeechobee. This is an area where they started to grow sugar back in the 1930s, and the muck from the soil from when they dammed the lake, you know, at the turn of the century, it's this nutrient-rich muck that really allows sugarcane to thrive. And like you mentioned before, there's a six-month harvest period where in order to prepare the cane for harvest, the cheapest and most effective method is to rid it of its leaves by burning it. And then it is hauled to the mills and turned into the sugar that you see in your, you know, on your supermarket shelves all across the country.
Maybe for folks who aren't from Louisiana or from parts of Texas or Mississippi where this is done, or particularly in Florida, help us understand why they're burning sugarcane.
It's very quickly rids the plant of its leafy outer stalk. If you've ever seen a sugarcane crop, it's this really dense plant. The only part of it that you actually need for producing the sugar, for taking to the mill and producing into cane sugar, is the stalk. And you want to get rid of its leaves. Now, there are a couple ways of doing that. You could mechanically remove them with blades, or you could burn them, which is what they do in Florida. They burn the standing stalks in the fields, and that releases smoke into the atmosphere. And keeping in mind that this is a rural largely low income, largely minority area that is kind of living among these hundreds of thousands of acres of cane fields and exposed to the smoke on a regular basis.
Now, say just a little bit more about these communities. Who lives near these cane fields?
A mix of residents, longtime residents who've lived there for generations, but the area is largely low income. A third of the population lives below the poverty line. It is mostly Black, mostly Hispanic community. And you have this mix of people who move to the area to find work. You have seasonal workers, some of them, you know, of Caribbean descent or of Latin American descent. And that's generally the makeup of the area in Western Palm Beach County, which is where the Palm Beach Post is. And that's where these sugar harvesters are mainly doing their harvesting.
Lulu, can you tell me about Thelma Freeman and her grandchildren?
Yeah, absolutely. So about a little over a year ago, we started reporting on the topic of cane burning, and we came across Thelma Freeman and her grandkids as a really compelling example of people whose lives are really sort of controlled in a way by sugarcane burning. Her grandsons both have severe asthma and spend most of their time 6 months out of the year inside trying to avoid the smoke. She even goes so far as to drive them outside of the city as often as possible, outside of the region, to take them to a playground, for instance, or to doctor's offices, because the smoke really aggravates, as she says, aggravates their asthma and their breathing problems. And that's really something that we found across the board with several residents that we connected with in the area when we were seeking to understand what it's like living among the smoke from sugarcane burns.
Aren't there federal laws that determine and help to ensure that whatever is being released by major companies into the air only goes above a certain level?
There definitely are. The EPA, basically in adhering to the Clean Air Act, has set federal thresholds for certain pollutants. But one thing that we found with this project that we did, which actually involved air testing, we collaborated with people in the community, as well as academics, to test the air ourselves and understand pollution trends. And one thing we found is that the federal framework for measuring this particular pollutant called particulate matter, specifically fine particulate matter, these tiny mixtures of harmful pollutants in the air, that it's ill-equipped to measure cane burning pollution in particular, because it's this short-term pollution where the federal government is generally measuring these pollutants using 24-hour and annual averages. Cane burns are unique in that they're happening in a certain time period. So they're basically burning individual cane fields across the region. Those burns generally last less than an hour, and they're localized. They're kind of across the area. And in addition to that, they're only happening during a sort of 11-hour, if not shorter, time frame throughout the day. So what we found were repeated spikes in short-term pollution and short-term particulate matter pollution throughout the day, but really contained to that sort of time frame that I mentioned where they're burning cane between 9 a.m. and about 8 p.m.
That makes a lot of sense to me. If you're looking at averages, right, as opposed mm-hmm. to those spikes, then, you know, if it's 6 months of harvesting, but you're dividing by 12, right, it's going to look right. half as bad. And if it's 2 hours of burning, but you're dividing by 24 hours, right, it's going to seem as though it's not as big a deal. But if you're standing in the ash as it's coming down, it's pretty clear. So I'm interested in this idea that your paper, that ProPublica, that folks who live in the community, as well as academics, are all having to sort of speak and bring this data forward. Are the sugar cane or the sugar companies themselves claiming that this isn't happening?
Yeah, it is really interesting that we had to bring it forward ourselves. I think that was one of the compelling reasons for doing this, was the lack of data that already existed. And as far as the sugar companies, they did respond to our findings. They criticized them, called them flawed and biased. And we actually wrote an additional story kind of addressing their criticisms point by point and how we took them into account when we launched into this sort of citizen science effort to really get a better understanding of air quality in the area and some of the health concerns that could be associated with exposure to this type of pollution. And they're standing by their you know, statement that the air is fine, and really leaning on, again, that federal framework we mentioned, those 24-hour averages that show that everything is fine. But we had experts review all of our findings from the sensors that we placed in the community, and they agreed that it called for a need for more monitoring and posed potential health harms, even in the short term, and especially because it is repeated exposure daily over the course of 6 months out of the year.
So what alternatives are there? As somebody who spent a lot of time living in Louisiana, this is a really different process.
Yeah, absolutely. Louisiana is very different. And frankly, the United States is kind of an outlier on the global stage for this. In Louisiana, for example, back in the 90s, they changed their harvest practice. They tweaked it quite a bit, but they still burn the sugar cane. They cut it first, which they say produces less smoke and soot, while Florida still burns standing cane in the fields. But other countries have shifted away from this after acknowledging major pollution from cane burning. Brazil and Thailand are in the process of phasing this out. And those are among the top five sugar producing countries, the U.S. included. Only China is the other country that hasn't taken steps to phase out, ban, or criminalize cane burning. In India, they have banned it outright and have even criminalized it. They fined and arrested people for violating crop burning bans after, again, acknowledging that it's contributing to major levels of pollution and also can be harmful to those nearby who are exposed to it.
Can you tell us a bit about the lawsuit that residents have brought against sugar companies?
Yes, a handful of residents decided to take this to federal court. This was back in 2019 when they originally filed their complaint. But they essentially complained, they claimed that sugarcane burning was causing respiratory problems. So despite sugar companies' attempts to have it dismissed by leaning on and citing frequently a monitor, the only monitor in this massive sugar growing region in South Florida, which spans about 400,000 acres. There's one monitor in the city of Belglade. And we also found that that monitor had been malfunctioning. It was flagged back in 2013, 4 years after it was placed, because of discrepancies in its air pollution readouts. And this is the monitor that is not only key to the defense that the sugar industry has been leaning on, it's key to this, you know, this motion to dismiss in this federal lawsuit. It is key when, you know, regulators are looking at air quality in the area. And it is one of the reasons why we decided to step forward and also, you know, take this proactive step of placing sensors in the community along with, you know, after the feedback from people who really just wanted to understand what is the air like? Is it healthy? You know, beyond this monitor, what can we find out about these pollution trends and our own health?
Lulu Ramadan is an investigative reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Lulu, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for this reporting.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
On Tuesday night, Major League Baseball's most talented players gathered in Denver, Colorado for the 2021 All-Star Game. The American League won the game 5-2. Just as notable as the final result was the presence of Los Angeles player Shohei Ohtani. Not only did Ohtani hit leadoff for the American League, he was also the team's starting pitcher. Now, taking on these dual roles is rare in pro baseball, where teams often do everything they can to protect their star pitchers from injury. But Ohtani, who got his start in Japan, has shown just how exciting it is to watch a player excel, both on the mound.
Ohtani on 1-2. Got it! Fastball!
And at the plate.
Oh, got it, got it, got it! 33!
Oh, wow, where did that one go?
Ohtani's success comes at a moment when Major League Baseball is dealing with an aging fan base and low game attendance that date back prior to the pandemic. But even as exciting players like Ohtani add a flair to the game that could pull in younger fans, baseball's gatekeepers have often used thinly veiled racism to criticize this emerging group of stars. For more, I'm joined by Kavitha Davidson, sports and culture writer for The Athletic and co-author of Loving Sports, When They Don't Love You Back. Kavitha, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So let's be honest, I'm a baseball outsider. It was definitely the incredible team at the Takeaway who kind of pushed me to think through this. But I got to tell you, preparing for this and watching Ohtani, I'm maybe a little bit hooked. So describe to me what really sets him apart as a player.
Well, so he's been described as the Japanese Babe Ruth, but I think that's unfair to him, if you can believe that. He's something that we've never seen before, frankly.
Okay, that is, I was also thinking he's much cuter than Babe Ruth, at least, you know, at the end there. So what are the potential risks of having a star pitcher who actually also plays as a designated hitter?
I mean, it's always injury, right? As you mentioned at the top, managers are trying to preserve their pitchers as much as possible, especially with how hard that they're throwing. But with someone like Ohtani, we haven't seen someone who can hit as hard as he does and pitch as well as he does. And it's really a generational, once in a lifetime thing that we're seeing him do. It's quite phenomenal to see.
So you're framing this as a generational, as once in a lifetime. It sounds almost Simone Biles-like, right? In the sense of, nope, we haven't seen folks do this before. But it's also getting kind of framed around anxieties around nativism and race. ESPN host Stephen Smith said something this week about, you know, Ohtani can't be the face of baseball because he uses a translator. Can you just talk a little bit about this mindset of kind of English-speaking centrality here?
Yeah, I have to say, I don't think that mindset around Ohtani is actually pervasive or widespread around baseball circles. Now, I think that speaks to a larger point of in America about immigrants needing to learn English in order to be successful or in order to be marketable. But Ohtani has all of the charisma that any native English-speaking player could have. He is the most exciting player to watch. And I think that it's extremely short-sighted. And Major League Baseball itself knows that it needs to market players like Ohtani, like Fernando Tatis Jr., who are not native English speakers, but play the game in such an exciting way in order to garner a younger and more engaged fan base. And Ohtani is definitely a pathway to that.
All right. So as you talk about garnering this sort of, fan base that is younger, that will, you know, fill those seats, especially once the pandemic is more fully under control, how much of that can happen with, like, the thing that is standard baseball, and how much of it means baseball is going to have to change what it is?
Well, baseball has constantly been evolving. Baseball has this image, and rightfully so, of being stuck in its own past and holding on to its traditions. And in a lot of ways, the traditions of baseball are part of what make the game really beautiful. At the same time, baseball and Major League Baseball as an institution has known that it's needed to evolve in the way that it markets its game, the way that it markets its players, and the way that the game itself is actually played. There, without getting too much into the weeds, there are all kinds of rule changes that they've been experimenting with improving the pace of play, with making the game go faster and all of that. But definitely, you know, we're coming into a generation of sports fans that needs action every second of a game and consumes their games and their medias in completely different ways. And Major League Baseball has realized that they're coming up against that barrier and they're trying to evolve and trying to make little adjustments to garner that future fan base and that next generation of fan.
So Kavitha, I actually do want to go ahead and get into the weeds a little bit because it does feel to me like it's that pace of baseball that is both the only thing that I've really enjoyed about it in the past, because we've got a minor league, you know, team where I live. And so we go out and you just literally spend all day hanging out with your friends. But I only occasionally glance at what is happening with players. But if I'm going to watch it on TV, I want it to move, 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 move. And I'm not even a millennial, right? So I'm wondering about, in those weeds, how do you make baseball move more quickly?
I mean, for example, they've instituted a pitch clock, so pitchers can't take a certain amount of time in between pitches to literally improve the pace of play. For doubleheaders, they've instituted a 7-inning rule, where if you have two games played in a day, then each game has to go to 7 innings instead of 9. There are little tweaks that they're making. They're experimenting also with on-field tweaks, the way that shifts maybe can and cannot work in order to improve scoring and improve, like, literally spacing on the field. But, you know, I think that the beauty of baseball is so much in those little subtle things that don't easily translate to TV watching until you've actually gotten a sense for the game. And it really is just the entry point. That's the biggest, for me, that's the biggest barrier for getting people into baseball is if you are comparing baseball to a game like basketball, where there's action, there's so much action on the court. Hockey is the most action on the ice, right, from a second to second perspective. But hockey is in no way the most popular sport in America. And football, which is the most popular sport in America, in a 2.5 hour game broadcast, there's about 14 minutes. That's not an exaggeration of on-field action. So I think that baseball has they have some room here to grow. But it really is, it's about perception. I think it's also about communities that you're marketing to. And Major League Baseball has a diversity and inclusion office that knows that it's needed to market to other fans, to younger fans, and it's really is working on this right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I did start watching golf when there was a Tiger Woods, and as exciting as hockey is, I sure don't watch it. So talk to me about whether or not the league can do enough to attract Black players and fans and bring that entry point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this all rests on having younger players, having players who exude sheer joy in playing this game. I mentioned Fernando Tatis Jr., who every time he hits a home run, it's a spectacle, and I say that in the best way possible. And Shohei Ohtani and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who won the All-Star Game MVP just last night. You know, we have a crop of really exciting young players who can cater to a more diverse audience, and I think Major League Baseball is embracing the fact that they need to embrace these players, and whether media or older fans are not, frankly, they're not going to matter in 20 years.
Kavitha Davidson is a sports and culture writer for The Athletic and co-author of the book Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back. Kavitha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, folks, that's the show, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Call us with your ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.